Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Source Material Comic Podcast, episode 260. Oh my goodness. I have never been more intimidated in my entire life to do a podcast. Luckily, though, I have two people here that have joined me to pick up the burden and lighten the load a little bit off of my shoulders. Welcome back to the podcast, Alexis Haina of Honeysuckle Rose Creations. Alexis, welcome back to Source Material. Are you ready to talk some Crisis on Infinite Earths tonight?
Nobody's ever truly ready to talk Crisis on Infinite Earths.
The main thing that I got to keep reminding myself is that there is enough people out there that have provided a ton of content for this book that I don't really have to saddle myself with knowing everything, all the ins and outs, and that's okay. We're here to talk about the book itself, some of the knowledge we have, and the fun we had reading it. With that being said, welcome back to the podcast, Al Sedano of Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast. Welcome back, Al. Thanks for coming in, man.
Oh, wait a minute then. We're wrong Earth. I don't think I've ever been on this show. You must have the other Al, the Al of Earth 3. Sorry.
Well, I'm curious as to what that podcast would be. So either that's Adam Warlock. Which one would the Earth 3 cover? I'm curious.
Oh, he does the show Everyone Loves Angar the Screamer.
God, somebody get the coordinates on the cosmic treadmill wrong again.
I hate when that happens.
Well, like I said, this was a intimidating thing to pick up. I'm at episode 260, and I have never covered Crisis on Infinite Earths on this podcast. I do know for a fact, just like I said, there's a lot of people who have written about this book, have done podcasts on this book. There is one podcast that I know in particular that, I mean, legitimately devotes maybe 2 to 3 hours a podcast.
The Crisis Tapes?
Yeah. Murd and Peter Rios.
Murd wrote his thesis on Crisis.
Yes, dude. He wrote a thesis on Crisis. That's amazing. It's amazing to me. So when I see all that came before my little piddly show, I'm humbled, number one. And number two, like I said, I'm satisfied with the fact that, you know, us three can come together and talk about this tonight and at least contribute our opinions and thoughts on the series itself to the Rattlechin Broadcasting Network. So with that being said, I want to talk real quick about the creative team. Again, this was an important book. As to the importance of it, I mean, I don't know specifically all of the nuances. I didn't get into all the history of it, but just from what I've heard in the past and you know, hearing podcasts talk about it, this was pretty essential to at least try and clean some things up for the DC Comics at the time. There were a lot of different, we'll say, continuities going on, different Earths is how they would put it, where certain heroes would be on one particular Earth and history may have gone a different way. And then we have the DC Universe proper, which is, I think, known as Earth 1 here in this book, where in 1985, we have Superman, Wonder Woman, all the DC heroes we usually know. But then we have another Earth where they weren't even on there. It may be the Freedom Fighters. So we'll talk about some of the important stuff of that. But like I said, it felt like this was something that had to be done in order to try and clean up DC and maybe make it a little bit more uniform. Creative team, written by Marv Wolfman and penciled by George Perez. This is 12 issues between April of 85 to March of 1986. A huge, magnificent crossover that brought a lot of characters that people knew and loved from over, my goodness, we're talking at that time 50 years of continuity. Did they go back any further? Yeah, so
yes,
they did.
Dr. Occult did appear a few years before Superman.
Okay.
And he's in there at least in issue 11, so
yeah, he's hanging out with Alan Scott Green Lantern, if I remember correctly, and they're tag teaming some stuff with the Magic Fuse.
I apologize, by the way, if I say Mark Wolfman, because for some reason I could have sworn for the longest time that was his name, and then found out later that I was an idiot. So,
oh, you should have went up to him at a con. I don't. Have you ever?
Held a Freudian slip.
Okay. I was gonna say I always pronounce John Byrne's name as John Byrne before I actually heard somebody say it. I went, "Oh, I'm an idiot." So don't worry about it.
Nice. Alexis, I know you frequent the convention scene. You ever just by chance heard that Marv Wolfman or George Perez was in the building?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure if they actually were, somebody's head would have exploded.
I think Perez just recently retired.
Yep. I'm not sure of convention scene, possibly, but I know he retired from active drawing. I think okay. It was either his hands or his eyes were getting too bad that he couldn't do active drawing anymore.
That's rough. That was really rough.
He is, I mean, look at his stuff here. This is 85, and he got better afterwards, and this stuff is gorgeous. Dude.
Incredible,
The amount of detail, the amount of, you know, just making sure that you can tell, even though that character may be in the background, who that character is. And the amount of characters on the front page on a page or in a panel is amazing. Marv Wolfman, I've seen his name on plenty of comics, specifically the New Teen Titans. But he's been around since the 60s.
I mean, Marv Wolfman worked for both Marvel and DC, probably, and some of the independent stuff too, but mainly those. He did a lot of stuff all over. And I mean, that's the reason New Teen Titans is most likely the reason why he was doing this, because that was basically their number one series.
Yeah.
Perez and Wolfman. So they had them draw this whole big thing, because why not have your number one team?
Exactly. Bring them on. This was happening, I think, right at the time of either the Teen Titans had just started.
A few years before.
Was it? Okay.
The Judas contract had already happened. The big story of Terra and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at this point, they were doing what was called the Baxter Run. This is at the beginning of the direct market of comic stores really becoming a big thing. And so what DC did was they took three of their bigger titles, New Teen Titans, Legion of Superheroes, because those were two of their top-selling books at the time, and I'm not sure if this was the one they're top-selling or they just figured what the hell, Batman and the Outsiders. And what they did was they relaunched them with new number ones, with better paper, and these books were direct sales only.
Oh, okay.
Only, so you couldn't get them on the newsstand. What they did with the original title is for a year, there were two books. So you would have the standard one, which was still sold on the newsstand as well as in comic stores, and then the new one, the Baxter, it was on Baxter paper. That's why they're called the Baxter.
Ah, okay. Ones. All right.
Those were sold only in comic stores. And then after a year, the original title went to reprints of those Baxter runs. So if you didn't have a comic store by you, you could still get those stories eventually. And that's why, when you see little editor's notes saying, see New Teen Titans 13, they're talking about the new series.
Got it.
Because the original series had already gone to, issue 50-something by this point.
Before we get into, the book and what happens here, I wanted to ask you guys a few questions about your history with this book. I remember this obviously being a huge event. Anybody who was collecting comics at some point had heard of Crisis, I'm sure. But for me, I'd never read it probably until, I would say, it had to have been sometime in college. So I'm going to say it was very late 90s, early 2000s. So we're talking 15 years after the event occurred. So I think my friend Dave, Golden Age Dave, who I had on this podcast years ago, Golden Age Dave, I think, had a copy of the trade. And he let me borrow the trade, and I read it. And at that time, I was like, wow, there's some important stuff. The thing is that just about, I'd say, 60 to 70, maybe 80% of this actual impact that it had on a lot of people probably flew past me, because I didn't recognize all these characters. I wasn't a DC guy. I didn't know the history. I didn't know the lineage. I didn't know what was coming before. I didn't know all the stuff that they were packing into this book. I read it and I was like, okay, well, yeah, that was a story. It was fun. I'm a big fan of time travel. I'm a big fan of alternate history. I'm a big fan of alternate timelines. I'm a big fan of alternate Earths. So that spoke to me. It was a fun time. How about, we'll start with you, Alexis. Do you remember when it was that you first read Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Yeah, actually, it wasn't too long ago. I've mentioned before on your show that I didn't get into comics until later in life. I really didn't read them growing up. It wasn't until later in high school and college that I actually started to take an interest in that kind of stuff. I was still interested in superheroes. I was brought up watching the Batman animated series, the Superman animated series, Spider-Man, X-Men, all of that. When I finally started reading comics, everyone always says, if you want to start reading comics, just go to your local comic shop and pick a character that you like. But instead, I started looking at event comics and different storylines that I would be interested in. The first two books I ever bought were Superman, Red Sun, and Kingdom Come.
Mm-hmm.
So nice. When I started looking at them, I came across Crisis on Infinite Earths, and I had heard of it. Again, it's like, you know, you hear that name in passing. And of course, I was familiar with the artwork of Superman holding the deceased Supergirl. I'd like to think that anyone with a passing familiarity of comics in general, whether or not they really are active readers or not, knows that image.
Yeah.
So I decided to go ahead and give it a try. And it was interesting for me because I'm just going to say this. Reading this book when you are not a huge comic books fan, what I called it like the comic book version of A Tale of Two Cities. You know what you're reading is amazing, but sweet Jesus, you have to force yourself to keep reading it.
Yeah.
It is hard. It's confusing. There are so many plot elements. There's so many characters in here that I had no freaking clue who they were. This was my first introduction to Commandy. Thankfully I knew Harbinger from the, the Batman Superman Apocalypse animated film.
Yes, that's right. She was in that.
Yeah, the one that introduced Supergirl. That was a good one.
Yeah.
So I knew her. But yeah, there was so, I'm looking at the Teen Titans and I'm like, okay, I know the basic Teen Titans, but who the hell is that chick in the rainbow sweater in the background?
I know, I feel your pain. So, I remember how dense this was when I was reading it back in 2000 or 1999 or whatever. And it was something that I had to push through because, yeah, there was a lot of stuff that was kind of lost on me. And even when I was reading it this go round, like the whole tower thing, I had forgot what in the world they were there for. I had to go back and like read it twice and be like, why in the hell are these towers here? And what is going on? What is the significance of them? And I didn't realize that Monitor had put them there. I had completely forgot about that when I read it like the last time that I read it, which I think was about 10 years ago. You know, I think I've read this would make it probably about the third time that I've read Crisis on Infinite Earths. And each time there's either so much in there that I just got to push through it and maybe it just escapes my mind. I don't know. But
yeah, that's probably the difference between reading it as it came out, where it's you're just reading one issue at a time because that's all there is.
Yeah.
As opposed to later on where you're reading a collection and you're just reading the collection. You're just reading the whole thing.
Yeah, you're absorbing every bit of it.
All at once, as opposed to, I have one issue and you have a whole month to digest what you read before the next one comes out, as opposed to reading them all in 4 or 5 days.
And the amount of detail that goes into every page. I mean, again, I'm looking at the Oblivion Upon Us story arc that starts with the Teen Titans with Nightwing on his motorcycle with that super disco outfit, which I'm sorry, I always laugh at that. But look at all the characters in there, and each one you can tell is a different superhero.
Yeah,
that's the amazing thing about Perez, and that's the problem with that Nightwing outfit, real quick, because he designed it. Is that's only something that someone like Perez could pull off. That's why they had to change his costume later, because other artists could not do that. They needed to get, they needed to slim his change his costume because other artists couldn't do what Perez could do.
Yeah, that is some, wow. Look at that. Look at how far that costume goes down his chest. I mean, it had a big dip right there in the middle.
That is some serious man cleavage.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, plus, you got characters, if you're reading that, if you know them now, look so different. I mean, look how different Captain Atom looks as opposed to what we think of Captain Atom now.
Yeah.
He is not this silver-covered guy with just the red symbol and the gloves and the boots. He has that whole human-looking costume.
Exactly. Now, was he, I assume this was one of the Charlton books.
Yes. Characters. Earth 4 was all the Charlton characters, which DC had just bought.
Yeah.
So this is their first appearance in the DC universe. And in fact, if in some of the early issues, it says that sometimes they kind of don't count that Earth. Like they're saying, there's like two other Earths instead of three, because this was when Watchmen was still being worked on. And they weren't sure whether it was at that time Watchmen was going to be those actual characters, not, Dr. Manhattan and Night Owl, but, Captain Atom and Blue Beetle.
Yep.
So they weren't sure if we were going to be using them again after like the first issue or two.
Captain Atom definitely looks different. And I picked up on that because I was like, I assume this Captain Atom after the merge at the very end sticks around and then becomes the silver guy.
See, that's one of the downsides of what they did. And it's something I thought they did again with New 52. Crisis was intended to simplify. But what they did afterwards was instead of saying, okay, this is how we're going to do everything, they let everyone do their own thing. So John Byrne does Man of Steel and restarts Superman. But Batman, it kind of just continues on. I mean, issue 400 is technically considered the end of the Earth One Batman. And issue 401, which is a Legends crossover, is the first appearance of the post-crisis Batman. But there's really not much of a difference until you realize that Jason Todd's origin has changed. By then, you know, Wonder Woman didn't exist anymore, so she never was a founder of the Justice League. Captain Atom's origin is completely changed, so that Captain Atom never existed.
Okay.
So, like, they did, it's the same thing they did after New 52. Like, Batman and Green Lantern, because they were popular, their stories kind of kept continuing, while other characters like Superman, Wonder Woman, kind of restart. Well, there's a clear ending for it. It's like, well, where's the beginning start? Like, so these guys were been around for a couple of years, but these guys weren't. They didn't learn the lesson from Crisis, which was have a plan and have it all be together.
Yeah. Well, all right. That aside, let me get to you there, Al. Tell me about when you first read Crisis and what your thoughts were on it and back then.
I didn't really start reading DC until the 89 Batman movie came out.
Okay.
And started with Batman and worked my way from there. So wouldn't have been until that. So I most likely, I know I read it by the time I started college. So we're talking early 90s. Anyway, so I saw the 89 Batman. I was 13 years old, almost 14, because I came out in the summer. And so that I already started reading Marvel. So I started picking up Batman and then other DC books. As you do, you know, as you start reading one thing, you go to the next one and the next one. And next thing you know, you're reading way too many comics. And so some point at that time, I picked up Crisis, and it was pretty cheap. It was like a dollar or so an issue. So I really didn't understand everything that was going on because I was still kind of wrapping my brain around multiple Earths and the fact that everything had changed a few years before. But it's something I've read a couple times because I knew big stuff had happened. And I did get the fact that, like, the Flash that was out then was the Kid Flash. And here's the death of the Flash before, or the fact that Supergirl dies, but she didn't exist anymore. And it just also, it fascinated me with the pre-crisis world, like the Earth 2 characters and the original Superman and the original Batman and his family. You know, the fact that, like, they would have these, they actually had a chance of having these characters get older and have lives. You know, the original Superman got married, you know, and Power Girl was his cousin, but more or less his daughter as well. You know, Batman, you know, Robin grew up, Batman got married and died, had a kid.
And that was the Huntress, right?
Yep.
Yep.
So that was just, I'm still fascinated by that kind of stuff. So that, I guess, started that.
Very nice. We come back to it again now. And obviously we're doing this because CW has launched their version of Crisis on Infinite Earths through the Arrowverse. And as of right now, I believe there are three episodes out. Is that right, Al?
Yep, that's correct.
Three. So there's three episodes out, and then the next two, well, time travel, because this is airing next week, but by this time, I think we should either have them done or they're in the process of being done next week, so whenever this is airing. Alexis Hanna, do you have anything to say before we hop into the Crisis?
I think the thing that I always found interesting about Crisis was that, you know, everyone talks about how this was the event, the first event comic, and how huge it was and how it's inspired Marvel and future DC. And this was not meant to be a massive, holy shit event comic. This was a cleanup.
Yeah.
This would be like finding out that Supermarket Sweeps was started because they just wanted to move to another location.
Interesting theory. That's number one, innovative, especially in the 80s. And number two, it's, you know, I'm sure that that is a daunting task. And just like Al said, who better to do something like this than the best team that they have available? Wolfman and Perez are just, you know, fantastic. So, Al Sedano, before we hop into the Crisis, what do you got to say?
Not much, except going off what she said. Yeah, that this is also something to remember. This is the first of those event comics, whether they meant it to be or not. It's the first one. So they're figuring out how to do these event books as they're doing this.
Okay, so what future event comics would you guys say comes close to the impact that Crisis on Infinite Earths gave us?
All the ones that they tried redoing. Zero Hour, where they tried fixing the issues they had after Crisis. And then Infinite Crisis is definitely a sequel to this. Flashpoint.
Yeah.
And for Marvel, Secret Wars. The new Secret Wars.
Yeah, Secret Wars 2015 was a lot of fun because it was very similar. You had a lot of different worlds, which is basically, you know, a lot of what-if stuff that came that was out there. They certainly weren't facing a continuity crisis like DC was at this time. Secret Wars 2015 was more along the lines of like, hey, we have all this stuff out there. Let's just do a reboot. because they could, I think.
They had to get rid of their ultimate line, but they wanted to keep the popular characters like Miles Morales.
Yes, yes, that's right. Hickman that had been working his way up to the like Secret Wars like for like a year or so?
Mm-hmm. New Avengers. Avengers.
I didn't have a chance to read any of that, but I remember hearing that it was kind of like, you know, they'd been building this for a while. But yeah, there's a few answers there, Alexis. Anything else there, Al, before I hop into the synopsis of 1 through 4?
No, I don't think so. Let's get into it and go from there.
I'm going to try and do this as quick as possible. This is so dense, ladies and gentlemen, to try and take this comic, this series, and just, you know, pare it down to bite-sized chunks was a very big task for me. So this first 1 through 4, I'm just going to do my best to touch on the very important parts. So here we go. Issues 1 through 4. A mysterious force is causing different universes to fade into non-existence. In order to try to stop this, a being called Harbinger recruits some heroes from across time and different worlds to come together and team up. Heroes and villains, from the Earth 2 Golden Age Superman to Arion, the mage and lord of Atlantis from 45,000 years ago, convene on a satellite in space. While getting their bearings, they are attacked by dark figures that come to be known as shadow demons, but are able to beat them back. Soon, our team meets the one that put this gathering into place, a being called the Monitor. Other important characters are introduced. The emotion-manipulating psycho pirate who, by the second issue, is abducted by an unknown being, later revealed to be the Anti-Monitor, and used against the heroes. Pariah, a person whose sole purpose in the book seems to be observing universe after universe as they fade away. We also meet Alexander Luthor Jr., the son of Lex and Lois Luthor from Earth 3, who, according to Wikipedia, has power over both matter and antimatter. Meanwhile, on Earth 1, the current most well-known DC universe at the time, time begins to fluctuate. At one point, Batman is approached by an image of a withering Flash with a dire warning of the danger to come. In issue 4, some more key players are introduced. Lady Quark, rescued by Pariah, she is the sole survivor of her own universe as it fell victim to non-existence. Our heroes are dispatched to different worlds / eras to guard 5 large towers put in place by the Monitor, the purpose of which is to align the frequencies of the 5 remaining universes in order to bring them together. In each instance, the shadow demons attack. I'm going to lay out the Earths here real quick so everybody kind of has an idea. Now, there were a bunch of Earths, like at the beginning of the book, that we watched fade away. I think one of which, like I said, was Earth 3, which that's the Crime Syndicate universe, right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, everyone's taking notes. There's a quiz later.
No, here we have Earth 1, which, like I said, DC Comics as we know it in 1985. Earth 2, which was created to explain differences, this is straight from the wiki, created to explain differences between the original Golden Age and then current Silver Age versions of characters, such as the Flash, and how the current Earth 1 versions could appear in stories with their counterparts. Then we have Earth S. Okay, this is the Fawcett Comics. Yep. That's what they have it listed here. Fawcett Comics between the 1940s and 50s. Ladies and gentlemen, if you know who Shazam is, Dr. Savannah, Mary Marvel, so it's basically the Marvel family, Black Adam. They also mentioned the Crime Crusader Club and the Squadron of Justice. I don't know much about those guys. Al, you got any?
I don't know who's on those, but I know they did. I mean, Fawcett had their own line, so they did have a whole bunch of characters. There was the Spy Smasher, and there was, I forget the others. But yeah, they had all their whole line of characters.
Okay.
So that must have been some of those other ones. I mean, yeah, and it was called Earth S because 5 and S looked similar. So they called it, when it was hand letters, so they just called it S.
Oh, okay. All right, then. Then we have Earth X. Now, on this Earth, Nazi Germany won World War II, and the Freedom Fighters, originally from Earth 2, fought to defeat it. It says most quality comics publications chronicled adventures from this Earth.
That's how DC worked. When they bought a company, they put their characters on a different Earth.
Then, now that we have Earth 4, which is the final and fifth Earth that is left living here. Earth 4 are the former Charlton Comics heroes, Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Nightshade, Peacemaker, The Question, Thunderbolt, and Judo Master. So there are the 5 Earths that we're going to be talking about throughout this series. And by the end of issue 4, a great betrayal occurs as Harbinger, not fully in control of herself, ends up killing the Monitor. Horrified, Pariah also watches as Earth 1 and Earth 2 appear to be consumed by the emptiness. So we've got a lot going on here in the first 4 issues.
One of the things I always loved about this, we mentioned this earlier, was all the detail that goes into the artwork and all the little, just the little hints in the back. One of the plot points of the first series is you have Firestorm and Killer Frost fighting each other. Psycho Pirate comes in and he has the ability to manipulate emotions. He's like the world's most powerful empath, I guess. Or as I call him, the you know, walking embodiment of an internet troll. And he, tell me I'm wrong.
I'm not disagreeing at all.
Nope. That's pretty good, actually.
Thank you. And he manipulates Killer Frost into falling in love with Firestorm. Mm. Side note, I know that these are coming from different time periods. I know that this book was published, you know, back in the 80s, but I'm still laughing at some of these outfits. You got Killer Frost in the hippie dress. Mm. You got Firebrand in the most conservative costume I've ever seen on a female superhero.
Yep.
But I love the little bits. Again, I love little bits with Killer Frost and Firestorm that even when it's a crowd shot and you see them in the back, you see her fawning all over him. She's got her arms around him or he's trying to push her away. Yeah. And I love that you've got all those little bits behind them even when they're in a crowd shot. That's a really nice touch.
And thank God Firestorm isn't trying to take advantage of that. He's just like, that's nice, honey. Could you keep like a personal distance wall of like 5 feet between us? That's the sexiest thing I can find in the world.
he's rather the gentleman.
Let's face it. If he actually had taken advantage of this book, would have been banned by the Me Too movement.
Well, thankfully, he was a decent enough person to not do that.
Yes. Well, I mean, they'd been fighting for a while, and obviously she was, right? She was like one of his main villains?
Yes.
I got that from the book, if I remember correctly. So, I can understand. He probably had a bit of a distaste for her anyway already.
I'm also going to take a guess here. The idea of the Flash trying to warn the different worlds and kind of getting stretched across them, the way he's able to communicate through different time periods. Anyone else think this may have been a little influential to Alan Moore when he did Watchmen and the idea of Dr. Manhattan being able to spread himself out through different timelines?
Watchmen happens, what, a year after this? Is it 85?
I could have sworn it was like 86 or 87.
I've got the internet right here. Watchmen... The Wikipedia says that it came out in 80. It was published between 86 and 87. So very, very good possibility. I'm certain that in the history of Barry Allen as the Flash, there was time travel stuff going on. What I really liked about what you're talking about is the fact that he shows up like in the first issue and we don't really get that resolution as to why in the heck it happened until like a few issues later.
Oh, until too late. And then you actually see those scenes from his point of view.
Yeah, and that's really cool. I love that touch.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Going by what you just said real quick, Alexis, it's actually, I just realized it. It's kind of funny then. In the Arrow series, or actually the Arrowverse, in the Flash series, who was Killer Frost, the character who became Killer Frost, was engaged to Firestorm in the first episode of Flash. Right, he was engaged to Ronnie Raymond, who is Firestorm.
That's right.
Okay, so they did their homework.
Nice, they did.
For all the things they do differently, you can tell those people are paying attention.
Yeah.
That stuff.
Let me throw a question at you here. Was there any characters that you were like, okay, who the hell is this dude? What the hell is going on? Anything that made you go start scratching your head immediately?
Yeah. A lot. Like I said, I was not a huge comic book reader before I started reading this. I think that's part of the reason I wanted to jump on this podcast and talk to you guys, because I wanted to be the voice that said, this is what it was like trying to read this when I had no idea who half these characters were. I knew that there were multiple parallel dimensions. I knew there were multiple Earths, and I knew the idea that every time a new, like you mentioned, every time a new company got bought, they just said, oh, okay, it's another parallel universe. So I did understand that, but yeah, there were so many characters I'm standing going, I have no idea what the hell is going on. I mean, I'll even mention, you see Simon with the PSI, and I only had seen him as a background villain in the Teen Titans animated series.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, I know who he is. I have absolutely no idea what the hell his character is or what he does, but I have seen him before.
I think this is the second story that I've read with him in it, and both stories were for this podcast. The other one, I believe, was Salvation Run. I think he's part of Salvation Run in that book as well, although I don't know if it's the same version. I doubt it, because obviously this is Crisis that's going on here, and he definitely looks different from what I remember in Salvation Run. I'm just looking at the two-page spread where they're all on the satellite. I had to go over that, which is probably one of the most fun parts about this book, is going through it with a fine-tooth comb and trying to figure out, okay, who the heck is that? Hence why there's a website that Al shared with. Al, do you know that one off the top of your head?
Sure, I actually have it on right now. It's prismnet.com, PRISMNET.com. It's a whole annotation of Crisis, all 12 issues. Plus, there was a Legends of the DC. It was a series called Legends of the DC Universe that came out in the 90s or early 2000s. Marv Wolfman wrote a basically issue 4.5.
Oh, really? Okay.
Featuring another Earth that gets destroyed.
Well, and so that and those annotations, I know I looked at the website. I mean, they just tell you panel one, blah, blah, blah is here, blah, blah, blah is there, and blah, blah. This person's here and that person's there. It's amazing, really. And that's, like I said, it's that's part of the fun is going through and trying to figure out who they are. And the two-page spread that I looked at with the satellite, that was the one point where I was like, okay, who can I pick out here? And I would be scared half to death if somebody told me you're going to be in charge of doing this with the DC Universe, and this is the first time you're going to do it, and you have all these characters that you want to put in there, and you've got to write dialogue or interactions with all these characters. I mean, my goodness, I know there's got to be a website that tells us how many specific characters show up in this book. Imagine trying to write dialogue and be faithful to every single character that appears in here. That's got to be daunting, scary.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing is like, well, the first time you read A Clockwork Orange and you realize you need one of those little translator dictionary things on the side to figure out what the heck Alex is saying.
Yeah. That those things are essential sometimes. And it's good that we have, I mean, the internet's a great thing. We all kind of know that. Sometimes it can be a bad thing. But this right here, that website that Al gave us, I mean, it's perfect to have kind of handy if you're going through the book. And you're just like, who is that? Okay, that's who that is.
Well, one thing that sticks out to me is, well, yes, they were doing this to clean up everything. They're also kind of celebrating the 50 years, which is why there's so many characters in there. They're trying to put everyone in that DC has published. And virtually everyone does have a cameo, at least a cameo appearance. Even some of their comedy characters like Sugar and Spike appear in a panel.
Oh, really?
Yes. There is
Sugar and Spike. I don't even know who those characters are.
Sugar and Spike was a comedy series they did in the 60s. They were babies. And the whole comedy thing, the thing about it was babies trying to understand the adult world. And adults just, so they have word balloons and they're talking to each other. But to adults, it just sounds like baby gibberish. It had nothing to do with superheroes. It was just their own little, it was just a little comedy, you know, it was a comedy series, you know, but like a sitcom.
They made a specific point to throw that in there.
Oh, yeah. There's one panel where somebody's watching. I think it's when Alex Luthor is talking to the United Nations in the second set of issues, like 4, uh-huh. 5 through 8. And you see somebody watching it on TV. Wow. And it's and you see the pictures. You see a picture of Sugar and a picture of Spike in like a frame on the wall behind them.
And here I was getting excited that I got to see Jonah Hex.
But you know who, by the way, you know who does not appear in Crisis?
I am at a loss, sir.
Hal Jordan.
He doesn't, does he?
He does not at all. John Stewart and Guy Gardner are the Green Lantern, the Earth Green Lanterns show up here, and Alan Scott, the original Earth, the original one.
Really?
But Hal Jordan does not appear at all in Crisis.
Huh. Wow. I mean, even the freaking Green Lantern Corps, I mean, are there at some mm-hmm. point. What is going on with Hal Jordan then?
He wasn't Green Lantern at the time, so I guess they didn't put him in. I don't know if they forgot or not, but I'm assuming they forgot because they put a cameo by everyone.
Okay.
But that's my point. But actually, that was the thing I was going to say is, since they were trying to celebrate everything they did, not counting some of their licensed characters like Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis, who had their own series for a while. Those, obviously, those people don't appear in here. But the fact that when they do like that first thing, we talk about the satellite scene. If they did the series now, that satellite scene would be Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, you know, the big characters.
Yep.
They don't have them in here.
You're right. You look at that scene. I mean, really, honestly, who is the, who are the iconic ones that anybody could point out? Well, Superman.
The original Superman.
Yep. Superman. You wouldn't, I mean, just somebody off the street wouldn't be able to look at that and say, well, that's, you know, Golden Age Superman. They just say, well, that's Superman. Cause that's kind of where I thought initially. And I was like, well, wait a second. No, look at the gray.
Yeah. I mean, you have a nice mix of all different characters in different Earths. You got Blue Beetle from Earth 4. You got, you know, from Earth 1, you got Cyborg.
Yeah.
And Geo-Force from the Outsiders, Dawnstar from the Legion. So like I said, you got a representative from each of the bigger comics. from DC. From Earth 2, you have people from both the past and the future, because you have older Superman and Obsidian from Infinity Inc., but you got Firebrand from the All-Star Squadron, so she's from World War II.
Yeah.
Nice touch with the satellite shot with Plastic Man and Elongated Man kind of stretching around the frames a bit. I like that.
Oh, that later one? Yeah. But I mean,
I apologize if we're looking at different satellite spreads. No, I think there's a couple in the book.
Oh, God, yeah, there is. There's a couple. Saying the satellite spread is like, well, which one? But, you know, I mean, you have Arion from, like, it's more like a sword and sorcery type book, you know, and they even show, you know, Commandy's in that, you know, doesn't join the satellite, but he's in that little section of them facing the towers. So it's kind of cool. It's like they weren't just going for the big characters. They were trying to show, like, we're doing all of DC.
Yeah.
Everything.
I think I would have been able to pull out Cyborg, Superman, and Green Lantern easily. Firestorm, probably. And Blue Beetle, for me. The rest of these characters, I would have had no clue, unless we... obviously, we got an introduction to quite a few of them there right before you get to the scene, which is good. It's great that they went back and they were like, we are going to do a good job showing you, you know, we're not just showcasing our big guys. We're showcasing everyone.
Yeah, I mean, those first few issues, they also get a nice showcase of their war characters.
Yep.
Because most of them show up there, the Western characters.
Yeah, so. the Batlash. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I had them all
like I said, I geeked hard when Jonah Hex made an appearance. He is one of my favorite characters, and not because of that piece of crap Josh Brolin movie.
And I was happy with Batlash, because I have the Batlash showcase, and that's so much fun. That's like the Maverick TV show.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Save, you know, he's not there to save people and do things. He's there to, you know, win at cards and, you know, meet pretty girls and have good food. He just happens to get involved and, you know, get stuck in the middle of things, mostly because...
Yeah. Did you ever see the animated Justice League episode where they went back in time and met Batlash and Jonah Hex? And
Yeah,
I love it. What's the line from Batlash? It's like, dang, I wanted one of them fancy ray guns.
Well, what else you got there, Al?
Well, that's one of the main things is I like the fact that they use everything. And like you said, it's pretty impressive of between Perez and Wolfman that they were able to work this out and figure out how to do this. And like you said, not just remember to include everybody, but also for Perez to put all those little touches in there of what characters are going to be together or what characters are going to be apart or what characters are going to be more likely to start talking to each other because they know each other. You know, and that first satellite scene in the first, like, I think it's issue one, even though they're different teams, Geo-Force and Cyborg know each other because Robin leads the Titans, Batman leads the Outsiders. Of course, they had a team up or two. So they know each other. So they kind of, it's kind of like at any party where you go to a big party and like, oh, I know those two people. I'm going to start go over there and talk to them.
Gravitate towards them. Yeah.
Well, that's what you do in a situation like that. You would look for familiar faces. I mean, imagine, you're suddenly transported into a room with a bunch of other strangers. You are going to be scanning going, okay, tell me there's someone I know here.
You know, Obsidian was talking to Superman because he's like, thank God I know this guy. You know, I know Superman. He's friends with my dad. That's cool. I can talk to him. That's one of the main things I can think of is that I love the fact that they include everything. And speaking of that, I'm very glad that Alexis, you're here because it's been so long since I read this. I know all these characters when I see them. I've read so much of them. I can't put myself back in that position of who is this? I don't know who this is. I'm confused by this. So it's nice to have somebody who is a bit closer to that than I am because...
Yeah, I'm looking at the World in Limbo satellite spread across the satellite splash page. And you've got Pariah, Alexander Luther, and Harbinger talking to the group of superheroes. And I see two Supermen. I see Batman. I see Wonder Woman. I see Robin. Again, this is the one that's got Elongated Man and Plastic Man framing. But I'm also seeing a woman in blue and pink flying. I'm seeing a woman.
Which issue is that?
Worlds in Limbo, pages 128, 129 on the trade.
Worlds in Limbo, so that's issue 5.
Okay. But yeah, there's like this one woman who is either a tornado or she's a giant white coil. I seriously can't tell. Nice little touch there with Cyborg and Garf, or Beast Boy talking. There's a man made out of metal who's got a giant L on his chest.
I'm going to say that's a metal man.
Probably lead.
Lead, yep.
There's three people in matching red and blue suits with goggles.
Okay. Oh, there it is. Okay. So let's see. So you got Elongated Man and the Plastic Man, and the other guy stretching is Mercury, the big red one. That's Mercury.
Yeah. I kind of figured from the symbol on his chest.
But the part I love is Swamp is right underneath Harbinger's feet, Swamp Thing, and then you got the war guys from Easy Sergeant Rock and Easy Company kind of looking like, what the hell is this thing behind us? Like, what? There's a freaking tree. Why is there a tree here? What's going on?
Okay, bottom left, the woman who looks like a giant white coil. Who is that?
That's one of the metal men, too.
It's Platinum.
Platinum, yeah.
I think it's apparently obvious. I have no idea who the metal men are. I think I need to move on.
Robot superheroes. And what was the other one you said? People in goggles? Where's that?
Very bottom of the left side.
Oh, those are the sea devils. That's an answer. I love that. Those are the sea
devils. It's like,
the
okay.
sea devils.
Like, underwater adventurers.
I was going to say, no, I officially know what how my grandmother felt when I told her she belonged in Hufflepuff House.
Okay, you see, especially in the 60s, kind of also had a different groups of people who didn't have powers, but kind of had a theme. So there was the Sea Devils. They did underwater stuff. There's Kit, which Cave Carson and his people had adventures underneath the earth. Rip Hunter and the Time Masters went through time. You know, no powers, just a group of people doing generic adventures, but in, you know, time, underground, in the water.
I'm assuming the gentleman who kind of looks like he's wearing the same outfit as Nightwing, but is black. I think that's Harold.
Let's see. Where's that again now?
He is right next to Plastic Man's head.
That isn't going to be Black Lightning, is it?
That's Black Lightning.
Okay. That's Black Lightning?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we got our...
That's... And in my head, even though I like the new show, in my head, when I hear Black Lightning, I always hear Sinbad's voice.
Okay. That was a bit, right? What was that on?
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
the Superman funeral.
That's right.
I'm Black Lightning. Me and Superman were like this, man. One other thing is realizing this time after reading it, because Crisis is different than some other series, like Infinity Gauntlet, for instance. It's all about fighting Thanos, and it's basically, it doesn't stop until they beat Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Thanos has the Infinity Gauntlet, snaps, everything goes to hell, they all get together, and then it's the heroes attack him, and then the cosmic powers, and then Adam Warlock, until they beat him. Crisis is different. Crisis is a war, so it's a lot longer, because like, for instance, like, we get this first few parts where it's the Anti-Monitor attacking and he almost wins.
Mm-hmm.
And then they fight back, beat him. And at the end of these four parts, they think it's over.
Oh,
except
dude.
For the fact that all the four Earths are kind of connected. But it's kind of funny. It's like people are like, oh, I guess this is the way the world is now. It's kind of very human. It's like things go crazy. And then we're like, well, I guess this is the way the world is now.
I was going to say, you're absolutely right about the war aspect of this because... I mean, you have the soldiers come at him first. That's going to be the Shadow Demons. And then we graduate to a battle with the Anti-Monitor like 9 freaking times.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know how many times he goes down and you're like, okay, he's dead. Nope, he's not dead.
Yeah, oh,
The guy comes back more than a Final Fantasy villain.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not like some of the crossovers now where like it's, okay, we got to beat the bad guy and let's go beat the bad guy. And everyone there trying to beat the bad guy. This is a big protracted war. This is like World War II or something where, you know, you don't just beat them in one time. You have multiple battles and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And sometimes there's lulls in the battle where things don't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. There's strategy involved here. I mean, I don't know how many times they had to, like, Harbinger sends them to 3 different eras in order to do whatever. And then that results in either the Anti-Monitor getting destroyed or pushed back. And then the next thing you know, Alexander Luther is sending them somewhere. And or it's just like chips on a battlefield. Plus, they have not only that, but they have to worry about all of these crazy extenuating circumstances where, our Earths are about to be destroyed if we don't get some stuff figured out.
And then all the stuff happening of like the time stuff going on where everything's going crazy and you have like dinosaurs in the future. And then when they think it's a lull, all of a sudden the supervillains band together and go, now we're going to take over.
Yep. Yes, sir. All right. Well, let's get into 5 through 8 here.
All right.
Issues 5 through 8. At the beginning of issue 5, we learned that Earth 1 and Earth 2, yes, if you remember right, at the end of issue 4, they disappeared. We thought maybe that was the end of things, but no. As the Monitor was killed, he released some energy. I believe this is how it went. He released some type of energy or had this and something in place to where he absorbed Earth 1 and Earth 2 into like a... I can't remember if they have a name for it. It's kind of like a pocket dimension. Null space? Okay.
That's what they call it. I'm pretty sure that's what it was called. Yeah, but like a pocket dimension.
It's funny. We just used null space in a recent was it a Marvel book? Yeah, it was Darkhawk. Me, when we did our Darkhawk talk.
Oh yes,
Null Space was one of the things that they used.
Where the body goes book. When he switches.
Yep, exactly. So anyway, so they're in Null Space. Earth 1 and Earth 2 are fine. There's some issues though. Alexander Luthor lets the heroes know that the other three Earths will also need saved, and that Earth X right now is potentially facing destruction at the moment. Now, when the monitor satellite is attacked, I can't remember how it gets attacked. Do you guys remember off the top of your head, like, what happens, what causes the monitor satellite to explode?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's the Shadow Demons again.
Shadow Demons? Okay, so it causes the satellite to explode. Monitor satellite is attacked and it's destroyed. A repentant Harbinger splits the heroes among the three Earths before they perish. And after some intervention, the three other worlds escape their fate from being destroyed and continue to exist alongside Earth 1 and Earth 2. So just to kind of give everybody out there that's listening an idea, you had Earth 1 and Earth 2 that were kind of safe, but the other three Earths were going to get destroyed. So now they were able to save those three Earths and bring them into this pocket dimension, I believe is how it worked with Earth 1 and Earth 2. But there's also some serious side effects. As Al was mentioning earlier, time fluctuations begin to intensify. During this, Lex Luthor, along with many of the villains of all of the Earths, have been teleported away into a ship that is being run by the evil Brainiac. Issue 7 lays bare how it all started, when a long time ago, an Owen scientist named Krona used technology to peer into the creation of the universe. However, a terrible accident occurs and the antimatter universe is created. Also, as a result of this, one universe became a multiverse. In the positive matter universe, I don't know how many times I got to say world and universe and Earth in this synopsis, but just be ready because it's going to be a lot.
At least 10 more.
At least. In the positive matter universe, the monitor was born. And at the same time, in the antimatter universe, the anti-monitor was born. Their war started soon after. Battling for ages, the two beings fall unconscious, and it isn't until another scientist, Pariah, discovered the anti-monitor's universe and accidentally woke him. Now the anti-monitor had knowledge that the destruction of the positive matter universe would allow him to grow more powerful.
Even though from a scientific standpoint, that's bullshit.
I have no idea about matter and antimatter.
No, seriously. If antimatter and matter, if matter and antimatter come into contact with one another, they cancel each other out, resulting in a massive burst of energy. Mm-hmm. You guys ever read or seen Angels and Demons, Dan Brown book, Tom Hanks?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was all part of that antimatter.
Exactly. So the idea is that these two, when the antimatter universe starts consuming it, it should cancel each other out. But I think what they're saying is that the anti-monitor, God, I'm going to hate this book by the time the show is over, gained extra power thanks to Pariah. So he is able to absorb rather than just have them cancel each other out.
There's at least one device that I know he constructs in here. That's the one thing that he gets thrown into that results in the death of Supergirl. So I don't know if he's using that device to funnel the energy from positive to the antimatter and then turning it into fuel or power or something. I have no freaking clue.
Well, there's one other thing he discovered, which the monitor didn't. If you go look at that origin sequence,
yeah.
He discovered pants.
Oh, well.
Because they're fighting that part where they're fighting, and the antimatter is fully clothed, and the monitor, he's naked.
Well, wow. Holy shit, you're right.
Look, he has not that. Discovered clothing yet, but the antimatter is like, dude, I got a suit.
Oh, wow.
Like, check this out. I got stuff on. I got pants. I got shirt. I got shoes. And the monitor's like, I got mutton chops.
And the war began.
We find out the Pariah, basically, the reason he keeps having to watch all these universes be destroyed essentially is just life itself punishing him for what he did.
That's his penance. Go ahead, man.
Would it be easier for you guys, instead of saying monitor and or matter and antimatter over and over again, be easier then go by that and just say shirts and skins?
If I can work that in here, I will. Battling for ages, the two beings fall unconscious, and it isn't until another scientist, Pariah, discovered the anti-monitor's universe and accidentally woke him. Now the anti-monitor has knowledge that the destruction of the positive matter universe will allow him to grow more powerful. After learning all of this, Okay, so this was laid out by Harbinger to all the heroes. The heroes assemble and head to face the Anti-Monitor in the Antimatter universe. As the Earth 2 Superman and others face off with him, they appear to be overpowered. It isn't until Supergirl tackles the Anti-Monitor, if I remember right, I think she runs right into him, tackles him, and they both fall into the device that appears to be fueling the destruction of the positive matter universe, sacrificing herself. Then the tide of battle turns. In issue 8, we turn our attention to the Flash, who, during these events, had been a prisoner of the Anti-Monitor. We also see that the Anti-Monitor has not died and is now planning to use an antimatter cannon to destroy the remaining 5 worlds. The Flash is able to escape and destroy the antimatter cannon. However, he begins to run so fast, he travels in time, flashing through past and future events. This action also results in Barry Allen's body withering away until the Flash is no more. And I think that is where I left it, because that issue 8 is where we end with the kind of like in memoriam Barry Allen, right?
Yep.
And we get the great battle cry, Psycho Pirate, eat Jell-O.
What is that? What?
It looks like he's being held in place. Flash is being held in place by kind of a gelatin wall that's keeping him from moving and gaining power. So he just starts spinning like crazy, and I guess the gelatin shit just starts flying.
And
everywhere.
He yells that at him. I do not recall this. Oh wow!
Yep.
Now there were some funny. There were some funny parts of this book. I know I tweeted one out there and tagged you guys in it. But I should have saw that and tweeted that one out immediately. I cannot believe I missed that.
You're slipping in your old age.
I am. I have, like I said, never been more intimidated by a book in my entire life. And when I started writing the synopsis for this, I would sit there and I would make notes as I read the book. And it would seriously take me an hour to read the book. So stuff like that, I was like, just pay attention to the big events. And then Gar hits me with, Marvel
Fetus.
Fetus Marvel. Okay.
I swear to God, if they don't work that joke into the next Shazam movie, I'm going to be very disappointed.
Well, yeah. They also don't show, I mean, granted, these were much more minor characters than Hal Jordan. They don't show Tall Marvel, Hillbilly Marvel, and Fat Marvel.
Are you kidding me? Those exist?
Yep.
Oh, wow. All right, Alexis, that was issues 5 through 8. Give me your thoughts.
Well, one thing I did like was the idea of when they show what is essentially the beginning of time, and it's a hand. And it's a hand holding a universe, essentially, in its palm. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes you wonder twice what happens next time you wash your hands. What did you guys think about what is essentially the redesign between the issues of the Anti-Monitor? That he goes from being almost a mechanical version of the Monitor, and then now he's kind of bullet-shaped.
Yeah, it's different. He looks more imposing, in my opinion. I mean, he definitely puts off this really imposing vibe. Was there any big reason for that other than just he had to come back with some different armor, Al? Do you know?
I think it was just because of the beatdown that Supergirl gave him.
Okay, so he had to contain himself in some way, and he has some new armor.
Those teeth, I swear to God, those things are like an 80s horror movie poster right there. I don't know why, but it's something about those teeth that just always scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, he's not a pleasant dude to look at. He looks like, what was the potato guys from Doctor Who?
The Centaurans.
He looks like an armored Centauran with like really a really old one.
His mouth is where the cavity creeps come from.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Feel old yet?
So, all right, Alexis, tell me about, I mean, we had the death of Supergirl happen in this. We had the death of the Flash. Did one weigh more than the other to you, or what was your thoughts?
I feel like the Supergirl's death weighed more on, because I feel the issues took more time to mourn her. I mean, we get the incredible speech by Batgirl. We get more of Superman's reaction. Flash dying, while it is impactful, and I love the idea that he travels so fast, he basically becomes one with the Speed Force. There is no other way to say it.
Yeah, though there was no Speed Force yet, but yeah, that's retroactively that works perfectly.
Yeah, it does. I don't think it hits you as much. Even, I mean, they're both incredible sacrifices. I do love that Supergirl basically goes down swinging. She knows she's not getting out of this, and she's not holding back. She's just decided every last bit of my energy, every last second of my life, I am going to spend beating the holy shit out of this guy.
And she does. I mean, she definitely does a great showing there. I mean, she beats the crap out of him, which is why I think he needed that other armor, because, you know, she gave him one hell of a beatdown.
But at the same time, when you look at the Flash, while you don't get as much mourning for him as you do for Supergirl, you get the images of him decaying and fading away, and he's conscious while that's happening.
Yeah, it's pretty horrific.
That's very nightmare-inducing.
Yeah, and it's also a little more tragic, I think, slightly, just because no one knows. So you don't know if anyone... I mean, they do tell us people will see it, but everyone at least knows what happened to Supergirl. People saw that. You know, tragic as it is, they saw it happen. They saw what she got. They saw her heroic sacrifice. The Flash's heroic sacrifice happens with no one knowing.
So I guess it becomes what's stronger of a superhero's death? Impactful or tragic?
I don't know. I think it's just a way of showing both, maybe. I don't know if one's worse, better or worse than the other.
Yeah, I was just hopping back in here to see when Supergirl was created. She'd been around for quite a while as well, right? I mean, she was probably
late 50s.
Yeah, I was going to say she's a very early Superman creation.
Real quick, Supergirl's first appearance, Action Comics 252, May 1959.
Okay.
It's also the first appearance of Metallo.
So Barry Allen Flash...
56.
Oh, Barry Allen Flash was 56. Okay. Okay.
Oh, and real quick, because I have the DC Universe app, so I went back real quick because I was just curious what you said about the showing the hand. And if you go back, I looked at Green Lantern 40, which is where that story comes from, and the hand is there too.
They even included that in the Justice League animated series. I mentioned earlier about the scene where they go and meet the Wild West guys, and then they go to the future, and we see future Static Shock and Batman Beyond. And then they chase the time traveler, and he says he's going to go to the beginning of time. And Green Lantern says it's like the Green Lantern have a theory. No one can look upon the creation of time, but we still see it, and it's a hand with what looks like atom particles in the palm.
Yeah, so that's always been part of DC since like Green Lantern 40. So that's pretty early on, sometime in the early 60s.
That's fantastic.
I guess I like that, for DC, that is the beginning of the universe. For Marvel, it is the one above all, which is pretty much Stan Lee.
So it's weighty. I mean, we just had, in that span of four issues, we just had two major deaths happen.
Yeah.
And that was probably a pretty relatively new thing. We've had this discussion before on this podcast. It's been mentioned by many other internet / YouTubers / podcasters that death was kind of wiped away there in the 90s with the death of Superman and the return. Here we're entering, this is the 80s. This is something that you didn't see a whole lot. You didn't see main characters bite the bullet.
Not that often. Very rarely. Not,
when they did, you didn't know if they were coming back. You didn't have all of the evidence that the 90s would give you showing that, this isn't going to be a lasting effect. It was something that was going to stand. And shoot, Barry Allen's death lasted
until 2006.
Exactly.
Supergirl never did. I mean, yes, there have been new versions of Supergirl since, but like the Barry Allen that he came back is more or less this Barry Allen.
Mm-hmm.
But the Supergirls that they've had since then, even the ones that are now like, okay, this is now once again Superman's cousin, still isn't this one come back. It's just a new version of her.
Mm-hmm.
So this Supergirl is still dead, technically.
All right, Alexis, anything else before I moved over to Al and ask him what he thought?
I'm sorry. I think I need to go reconnect a few synapses in my brain.
Wipe a nosebleed away. All right, Al, what are your notes here, man? I mean, we've talked about some of the big beats, but anything else you have sitting there?
Well, actually, it's a very little beat, but it's something I've noticed, especially in these few issues. It goes back to George Perez. Look at the two Supermen. Their costumes are different. I'm not just talking about the symbol. The Superman of Earth 2, the original one, it almost looks like a sweatshirt. Like, if you look at his wrist, there's little lines on the costume, like, of the way the costume goes around his arm. The other Superman does not have that. That's just something I always find fascinating when reading this. It's like, he's actually putting in that little detail that is, the cloth of his costume is different than the other guy's cloth.
Yes.
I mean, it's a minor thing, but it's, considering everything he had to do, you would never notice if he didn't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that, when they're looking at these things, they're like, how can we've got to be able to have the two Supermans in the same panel and you know which one's talking to who.
But the gray hair is good enough.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Hence the gray hair. There you go. That's all you had to do. just like you're saying, if you look at the suit itself, that harkens back to that golden age.
I like these ones where they get, we get now more of an explanation of what's going on. Like she's, you know, like I said, we get that whole thing of the history. And then those, just those two epic issues, 7 and 8. I mean,
back to back. Could you imagine picking those up off the shelf? Supergirl just died. And the Flash just died. I mean, you wouldn't know what to expect coming out of issue 9. You'd have no clue.
I mean, the Flash is basically, his first appearance is usually generally considered the beginning of the Silver Age. Because while Superman, Batman, Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and I think Green Arrow were still being published, so the same characters, the others weren't being published anymore. And the Flash is when they first brought one of these characters back in a new version. And so, like, the Flash is considered, like, his first appearance is generally considered the beginning of the Silver Age.
Yeah.
And so now he's dead.
Yeah.
And
that's big. That's a big deal.
That's, you know, and his title's over and he's canceled with 350, and now he's dead and gone. And what the hell are they going to do
now? What are they going to do? Yeah. You have no idea. So I didn't put this in my synopsis, and if you know off the top of your head, great. If not, that's fine. But Red Tornado, all right? Mm-hmm. So he gets reprogrammed by the Anti-Monitor, and I think he shows up wreaking havoc at one point, but then he gets deactivated. Did he have a bigger role somewhere that was like in maybe in the tie-ins or something, or was this just something that...
Probably the tie-ins, but I haven't really read those tie-ins. I really, now that I have access to pretty much everything there, I probably should go through and read those tie-ins.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that, like, from reading things about Crisis, they had a list of characters they were going to kill and a list of characters they were going to change. And while, obviously, after Crisis, not everyone, you know, people don't remember exactly what happened because they didn't know there was, you know, multiple Earths anymore.
Mm-hmm.
His changes were still there. Red Tornado appears afterwards in Firestorm as like an Earth Elemental. And then later on shows up in Primal Force and then in Young Justice as just like an almost empty shell. Like he can't talk. He does, you know, he's, you know, they don't really know what's going on inside his head.
Okay.
The changes from him continue on. Like if you read all, go through all the appearances of Red Tornado after Crisis, those changes continue, you know, from this. You know, it doesn't just get wiped away. It's not like Supergirl's death where Superman doesn't remember her after that because there never was a Supergirl. You know, his changes do continue on.
Well, anything else before we move into our next synopsis and finish this thing out?
I don't think so, because I think we basically talked about everything already.
So issues 9 through 12. In issue 9, time is still wonky. I mean, oh my goodness. All five Earths are still having some issues. But worst of all, Brainiac's plan is revealed. Teaming with Lex Luthor, the pair organized an attack while all five of the Earth's heroes were still on Earth 1 and Earth 2. This left the other three Earths without heroes. Teaming with Lex Luthor, the pair organized an attack while all five of the Earth's heroes were still on Earth 1 and Earth 2. This left the other three Earths without heroes, and that was an opportunity that the diabolic duo could not resist. They now ask for unconditional surrender of the heroes or destruction of all five Earths.
Talk about kicking them while they're down.
Yeah, no kidding. The heroes and villains wage war on all the Earths. During this, Jay Garrick reaches out to Wally West and convinces him to use his powers to join the fight. I think at this time, and if I remember correctly in the book, Wally... Was there something that was like his powers were causing some kind of a reaction in his body where he couldn't? Any idea?
So I don't know exactly. I wasn't reading those issues of Titans, so I just know kind of what we get from here.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, it seemed like Wally West that obviously was not doing Flash things. Kid Flash things, I should say. So Jay Garrick reaches out to him. This is the Justice Society Flash. Reaches out to Wally West and convinces him to use his powers to join in the fight. Finally, the otherworldly Spectre shows up. Now, when you see the Spectre, you know stuff's going down, okay? Spectre shows up and tells everyone to knock it off, as the danger to everyone has still not abated. The villains agree, with a new recruit joining the fray by the name of Superboy from Earth Prime. A new plan has been put together that is going to require two teams. Now, I'm going to stop right here because I've drafted Al Sedano to kind of give us an idea of who the heck Superboy, he's not known as Superboy Prime here, but he's Superboy from Earth Prime. Can you give us an idea as to who this guy is?
So, as one of the Earths was called Earth Prime. Earth Prime was basically a sort of fictional version of our world. There were no superheroes. They just basically used that as a reason to have the comic creators appear in the comics. I know one of the earlier appearances, there's a two-part story in the Justice League where the writer Elliot S. Magan somehow ends up on Earth 1 or Earth 2 with superpowers and starts going crazy and starts taking it over.
Okay.
And then gets sent back. So it was a it was basically supposed to be, quote unquote, the real world.
Got it.
Although obviously once it's in fiction, it's not the real world. They decided for some reason to introduce a super character for that world. It was a kid whose name happened to be Clark Kent, but he was not from Krypton as far as he knew until he found out that, oh, no, actually there is a Krypton and I do have superpowers and I'm Superboy. That basically was it. It was just, he was the Superboy of that planet. He just, it was supposed to be the real world. And so he wasn't anymore. And that's why it's called Earth Prime. Because it's supposed to be, because remember, when they're naming these Earths, they're not really naming them the way they would if you would name them if you existed there. I mean, obviously, Earth 1 should be the original Earth with the original Superman and the Justice Society who have been around first. And then Earth 2 should be the one with, you know, the Silver Age characters. But, well, at the time they did that, the Silver Age characters were the ones being published.
That's so right.
Therefore, they get to be one.
Yeah.
You know, the other ones too. And that's why they call it S. Because, well, it's easier, you know, better to write an S than a 5. And Prime, because it's supposed telling us it's our world. But it's like, why would they call it Earth Prime? You know, there was no reason why it was Prime. It wasn't like it was supposed to be the real world, you know, the original Earth or anything.
Now,
so
we watched
Superboy from another planet, another Earth. That's all.
How in the world does the Superboy show up here then? Do they even cover that?
That's, I believe, in an issue of DC Comics Presents.
Okay. All right then. Because, so, I mean,
it's like one of the side stories.
Most of the time we're shown, like, how in the world these heroes come together. And Superboy Prime just kind of shows up out of nowhere. And I'm like, how did he get there? Who went and got this guy? All right. Well, if it's in another book, that's fine. But here he is.
And that's why he's such a problem later on in Infinite Crisis. Because he's still that Superboy Prime. He still is the powers of Superman from pre-Crisis, which means moving planets.
Yeah.
Which is why he's so much of a problem to deal with, because no one has that power level anymore. You know, Superman doesn't have that power level anymore. The Superman we have now, you know, Superman we got afterwards is basically more or less at the power level that, like, the Earth 2 Superman was at.
All right, well, okay. A new recruit joining the fray by the name of Superboy from Earth Prime. A new plan has been put together that is going to require two teams. One team of heroes to face off with the Anti-Monitor and a team of villains to travel to Oa 10 million years in the past to stop the scientist Krona from accidentally creating the antimatter universe. The villains fail. However, with the power of the Spectre on their side, the heroes are able to stop the Anti-Monitor. But the result of the battle is a tremendous blast. The next moment, heroes are awakening in a world that seems familiar and foreign at the same time. As a result of the energy discharge, a single universe has been created, and some of the heroes from other Earths are not recognized. But having barely any time to reconcile this, by the end of the 11th issue, the Anti-Monitor still lives, and he pulls the Earth into the antimatter universe with the intent to destroy it. In the last issue, titled Final Crisis, the ultimate battle has arrived. The Earth is now besieged with shadow demons. While in space, using specific heroes and their powers, Alexander Luthor attempts to direct the fight to take the Anti-Monitor down. Each time it appears he is defeated, the Anti-Monitor rises back up. Until finally, they take out a sun that was powering the Anti-Monitor. Now, Alexander Luthor opens a portal to bring the Earth back into the positive matter universe. Arising once again, the Anti-Monitor absorbs the power of his shadow demons to regain his strength. As the Anti-Monitor seems to get the upper hand on the heroes, the evil Darkseid, oh yeah, we got to get this guy in here. The evil Darkseid, who was recruited by Rip Hunter and Brainiac, is somehow able to remotely control Alexander Luthor's powers, dealing a devastating and near killer blast to the Anti-Monitor. Earth 2 Superman who threw him into the sun, or was that our Superman?
Earth 2 Superman. He's the one that stays behind.
However, this sets off a chain reaction that is going to destroy the antimatter universe. At the last minute, Alexander Luthor transports Earth 2 Superman and Superboy Prime, the only two heroes left in the antimatter universe, into a pocket world inside him. Okay,
yeah.
That's weird, but am I right there?
Yep, he basically creates a little pocket dimension, and the two of them, plus Alex Luthor and Superman's Lois.
Yes, she shows up.
It's basically to give them a happy ending, because they're not going to be showing up anymore afterwards. So,
yeah.
And as I'm looking at the annotation, it said, that character, you know, Superboy Prime, it said, this is not the same character as a Superboy who had been a DC mainstay for decades, which was, you know, Superman as a kid.
Yes.
But it's intended to, quote unquote, represent him. So it makes sense that they would put, they kind of like, okay, let's give these guys a happy ending, because you know, this is the original Superman and the original Super, and this is Superboy. Let's not kill them off. Let's just give them an ending here. And, you know, they're gone forever or until Infinite Crisis.
At the end of the story, the Earth is safe in the positive matter universe. In the epilogues, we see where now it's Earth 2 Wonder Woman who did not die. Right. She lives happily ever after, like with the gods. Am I right there?
Yeah, her and Steve Trevor go live in Olympus or something.
Okay. Mourning for many of the deaths that occurred during the story. And this, what appeared to be Wonder Woman at one point died, but we understand she just gets, like you said, she gets, what was the word that they used? Devolved? She gets devolved.
Back into clay. Yeah.
Back into clay. But, you know, Supergirl, Flash, we watch Dove of Hawk and Dove, which is Hank Hall's brother, Don, who gets killed.
Yes.
Huntress dies. Robin dies. This is Huntress from Earth 2.
And Earth 2 Robin.
Earth 2 Robin dies. You know, there's a big impact on some of the characters that went into this. They're no longer living. They got killed. But one of the bigger moments of the epilogues, I believe, is where Wally West agrees to become the Flash. After this had all happened, that disease I'd mentioned earlier, or whatever was causing him not to be able to use his powers, has disappeared.
Oh, I think it had something to do with the fact, I could be wrong, and I could be remembering maybe a later story.
Okay.
But I think it had something to do with the fact that he got his powers, like, prepubescent. So it had something to do with puberty and then, like, his body changing, and that effect, it was affected by the chemicals and stuff in him that gave him his powers. And I think that's what was causing his issue with that. He couldn't use his speed anymore. It was killing him.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was definitely worried about the toll it was going to take on his body. So after this universal reset, that's gone.
Yeah.
And he picks up the mantle. Obviously, the Flash, Barry Allen Flash, is dead. And when he realizes this, he discards the Kid Flash moniker and decides to become the Flash. And then, of course, our final bit is the Psycho Pirate, who finds his... He doesn't find his way. I'm sure they threw his ass in there. He is in the Arkham Asylum, babbling about everything that happened before his eyes. And, of course, no one remembers or even cares to listen to what the Psycho Pirate has to say.
Until Grant Morrison brings him back an Animal Man.
All right. What's old is new again. We shall use this and write about it. Which, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens just in these 12 issues. I thought, man, that would be a fun side story to write, which it may have dang well been. But there was a lot of different stuff that would have been fun to kind of discuss, or at least maybe write an issue. You'd mentioned how somebody had wrote like a 4.5 an issue 4.5 or something. There's a lot of space in here and a lot of like just opportunity to use some of these characters and their interactions and the event that's going on around them to write an extra story.
Would have been
a lot of fun.
I mean, they show that a couple times, like when Blue Devil gets kicked over to the Omega Men and it's like, see Blue Devil, whatever issue, to see what happens to him there.
Yeah.
Or there's a Wonder Girl goes off to look for her husband with Firehawk and that's like an issue of Firestorm. Actually, my favorite, which has nothing to do, I'm sure never appeared anywhere else, is I think it's Lois Lane interviewing people from different times, and then there's a caveman who starts eating the microphone. I love that part. She's like, you're obviously from the prehistoric crunch. He just starts eating it. That's my favorite bit.
Appropriate response. Tell me all about it, Alexis. What were your thoughts on how we finished things out here?
The idea of putting the monitor tapes at the bottom of each page of Death at the Dawn of Time was a very stupid idea because I kept accidentally reading it while I was trying to go through it, and then I kept getting confused.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I understand the style, of course. You know, every artist has their style and how they want to portray what's going on the page. So when I hit that happened once for me, where I was like, okay, page one and page two, I'm like, okay, screw this, I'm just going to read the monitor tapes first and then I'll read the rest of it. Yeah, because I mean, it was confusing.
Yeah, that's something that has a benefit of reading a physical copy as opposed to digital, because it's probably easier to read one or the other first.
Yeah,
you know, either the main story and then monitor tapes, or monitor tapes first and then go back and read the rest. If you're reading it digitally, you have to read those. It just kind of, you know, brings you to that panel.
Oh, yeah. It's when you're scrolling it. Yeah, it'll bring you down there to that zoomed in part of the panel. Ouch.
Yeah, it's easier to do it the other way. It's easier if you're doing that physically to read it that way, because that should be read separately, because they did the same thing in Legends. And like there's an issue of Legends where they do something similar. And so, again, it's easier to read that on its own.
Agreed.
Honestly, Death at the Dawn of Time was a harder issue, I think, to read because there were some more tie-ins. There's a lot more annotations in this episode than in this issue than I think in others. A lot of times it's like, see this in this issue, see this in this issue. And I'm sitting there going, huh? Mm. The start of this one was a lot harder to get through.
Downtime part. So it's like, okay, see where everyone is. Like there's that whole sequence of Starfire and Jericho and Nightwing leaving Earth. And that has nothing to do with Crisis. That's just showing where the Titans are at this point.
Yeah.
You know, that has nothing to do with Crisis. That's just like, hey, let's try and sell some of our books.
And also, not going to lie, I was confused the first time I read this because this was sort of my biggest introduction to the Spectre.
Oh, yeah, okay.
My introduction before that was the animated short.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, with the one, Alyssa Milano does the voice?
Yes.
Oh, that is so good.
It is, but it is a cruel underrepresentation of what the Spectre actually is and his power.
Yeah, he's, oh my goodness, what kind of Marvel analog would you say here, Al?
I don't even know.
I'm trying to think. I think of the Spirit of Vengeance, and that just takes me to Ghost Rider, but Ghost Rider is not on the level of this. He's not.
I want to say more cosmic, but it's not cosmic Ghost Rider.
No, then you got to go cosmic Ghost Rider, and you don't want to say that either.
And speaking of Spectre,
he's like Ghost Rider crossed with Uatu.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And speaking of that Spectre short, have you ever seen the Spectre episode of Batman Brave and the Bold?
I have not.
Where he turns a guy into cheese and then brings rats in.
Ooh.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah. If you want to know more about the Spectre, I would say read the 90s Spectre series by John Ostrander and Tom Mandrake.
Okay.
That really gets into the whole Spectre and the fact that he is the spirit of God's vengeance. You know, Sodom and Gomorrah? That was his work.
This is a hard book to get through when you're not, you know, huge into comics. But there is no denying that when you finish it, you feel a sense of accomplishment. You know, you come out with a better understanding of comics as a whole, even if you don't totally get all the characters. I mean, you know, we just did a whole thing talking about Superboy Prime, you know? Mm-hmm. I really didn't know that much about Superboy Prime when I picked up this book. Other than that, I know a lot of comic book fans hated his guts.
But yeah, although that, to be fair, like I said, that's the wisdom of him later on. Because as you see here, he's nothing like that version.
Exactly.
That's a crazy version of Superboy Prime. That's a Superboy Prime who's been stuck in solitary for 20 years and has gone nuts.
Yeah, I mostly just know that when Linkara shows Superboy Prime on atop the fourth wall, he makes him talk like this. This is really a great book. And when you finish it, I feel like you feel like you're closer to understanding comics as a whole. I feel like reading this, you feel like you've taken a bigger step into becoming more of a comic book geek. It's like the first time you stay up all night playing a video game. You know, it's like you sit there and go, wow, I can't believe I've actually done that. And I'm proud of myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I identify with that. I do. I really understand after finishing this, this is a piece of history. I mean, this is something that will always be referenced when you're talking about some big event. They're going to compare it to this.
Yeah.
That's just the way it's going to be for a very, very long time, if not forever. Reading this is great because, number one, you push through it. Even if you didn't understand everything and everybody that was in it, you got to see what the end goal was. And that was to bring, you know, these characters who, for all intents and purposes, were living completely separately now into one controlled universe. And that's a big deal. That's something that hadn't really been done before on the scale that DC did with this. So big accomplishment, and reading it definitely was a big accomplishment. So, all right, Al Sedano, tell me all about it, man. What are your thoughts on these final four? Final thoughts altogether? Give it to me.
Well, obviously that last issue is very epic. But before we even get to the epic, there's a lot of little things in here that I just really like that I'm not sure how much they did before, but I know I saw a lot of bits of it afterwards. Like the fact that there's a community there. Like issue 11, when they first wake up and you find out the world, it's one world.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman goes to find Superman. And then they go to find Jay Garrick. And I like that little bit. He's like, oh, I know. It's like, Joe should know us. Me and Lois have been here for dinner plenty of times. It's like, not everyone's going to know everybody, but it's like, some of these people are friends. They don't just fight together. They have cookouts together. They have it's like, it's kind of like the little bits of like, oh yeah, these people actually have lives. You know, when they're not saving the world, they go hang out.
Mm-hmm.
They have barbecues. And, like, Kid Flash is already there because, like, these are the friends that they're going to talk to. It's like, okay, weird stuff's happening. I can't find Barry. Let me go find Jay.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that. I like that stuff. I like that little bit. I also like when we finally find out when the characters finally find out what happened to the Flash. And, like, you see what has happened to the Psycho Pirate is he's, like, pulling at the Flash's costume, begging for him to come back and save him. Because, like some of the worst villains, or some of the worst villains you love to hate, he is a coward. The moment that things are not going his way, he's looking to the heroes going, save my butt.
Mm-hmm.
I know I tried to kill everybody, but please save me. Because all I care about is me. And he's pulling at the Flash's costume, begging, going, no, you can't be dead. No, please, please, please help me. And then Kid Flash is like, get the hell away from that. And beats the hell out of him. And then, of course, the awesome send-off that the original Superman gets. Because, I mean, even though, yes, one or two characters like Dr. Cold appeared first, it all started with Superman. You know, the whole what we know of comics started with Superman. DC's got to explode with the characters because of Superman. All those other companies were trying to copy Superman, you know? So the fact that it all comes down to him to save us, to save everything. You know, it's not the more popular character that's still going to be published, the original, the modern Superman. It's the original one. He's going to save everybody.
That's good stuff. That's them knowing and absolutely paying honor to what came before.
And then there's the unintentional comedy of the multiple times they say they would not be forgotten about characters who will be forgotten completely.
Yeah. You know, the one character, just real quick, the one character that I thought was so interesting that came out of this that I didn't recall ever seeing anything afterwards, but I know there was some stuff because I'm looking at a cover that has her on it, and that's Lady Quark.
Mm-hmm. I did kind of notice it's like they build her up so much, but she really doesn't impact the story as much later on. And I don't think I've ever seen her in another issue.
I didn't know she existed after this.
Yes.
And when I read it again, it was one of those things where I was like, I don't remember even reading about her originally. So again, talking about characters that you wouldn't forget, I forgot about Lady Quark in this series. And then, like I said, I hadn't seen her after that, but she was built to be like, first off, when we see her in these issues, it is very tragic. She watches her family. I think they're like the only superhero family on that earth. Is that right? Or
more or less. Yeah. It's like the superhero. It's like they're the royal family of that planet, and the royal family has powers.
Okay.
So they're the rulers and protectors.
All right. So she watches her family fade away to nothing. And
her husband and child.
Yeah. Pariah comes in and pulls her out of there. And I was like, oh man. And she, of course, throughout most of the issues, she's upset with Pariah. Clearly, she wants to be with her family, dead or alive. She doesn't want to be where she's at. She's very, it's a very tragic existence for her. So, I mean, I think she factors into the final battle with the Anti-Monitor in a small way, along with Dr. Light, who was created by the Monitor. Yes, Dr. Light?
Yeah.
Dr. Light. So, but I was like, man, I want to see more of this Lady Quark. I want to see what happens after this. Obviously, she's so upset about losing her. So do you have any idea, or did you ever read anything afterwards that included her? Did you? Okay.
Yep. Well, two things. First of all, there's a weird little section of DC that I always find fascinating. It's that little bit after Crisis, but before they really reboot everything.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a period of time where the characters still know what happened. Like, because there's a few issues of Superman that come out. Because if you look at the crossover issues of Superman, it's like 413, 414, 415. You know, those are the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of that end this, you know, the story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, is issue 423. So, like, there's a period of several months where it's like that weird little, like, it's this world after Crisis, but it's not the what they call post-Crisis.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So I know she appears once or twice in there, but afterwards she does appear in the series called Legion. Not the Legion of Superheroes, the one called, it's L period E period G period I period O period M period. Basically Space Cops. Think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she appears in there. I think they retconned her to just be an alien, but she's part of that group for most of that series. I believe she dies towards the end of that run. It had like 70 issues.
Okay.
I think she dies around like 67 or 68. That's where you would find Lady Quark. And I will say at least the first two or three years of that book, which I read, was really good.
I think me and Mark were touching on some of the stuff that had Lobo in it at some point.
Yeah.
Or we were going to read some stuff with that had Lobo in it.
Yeah, it has it's the son of Brainiac leads this group.
Okay.
And he does things. He's a good guy, but he's very Machiavellian about it.
Yeah.
So he's an asshole. But unlike Superboy Prime, he's trying to do things for the greater good, but he's also kind of an asshole with a big ego.
What do you think of Darkseid and his appearance in this? I mean, it was I didn't expect him to have a hand in things, because they just kind of, it seemed like he was ducking out, like, I don't want him to pay attention to me, therefore I don't have to worry about him. And then right at the end, all of a sudden he can control Alexander Luthor?
Well, I mean, they're still acknowledging the fact of how powerful Darkseid was, but this was before Darkseid was basically used for everything. I mean, now Darkseid's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now they realize what a character they have, they use him constantly. But back here, Darkseid barely had, I mean, outside the books by Jack Kirby, Darkseid only had a couple appearances. He appeared in like a just JLA, JSA crossover story, like 183 to 185, I think it is, and like in the Great Darkness Saga and the Legion of Superheroes, and that's pretty much it. You know, they really didn't use him much, so they're kind of like, let's use him too, because they really don't use any of the new gods.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think they make an appearance like in a panel, and that's it. I mean, they're rescuing some people, if I remember correctly. I think it was the new gods, wasn't it? That they were like down there on their bike. Who was?
That's what I'm thinking of. But they're part of the new gods. That's just like one group of them.
Alexis, I was just going to say, you've been awful quiet. Thanks for putting up with me and Al.
Yes, thank you.
I
had some stuff to contribute, but nowhere near as much as you two did.
Okay, well, I believe this is going to bring our discussion of Crisis on Infinite Earths to a close. I want to thank my guests, Alexis Haina and Al Sedano. We're going to go ahead and get into plugs. So, Alexis, we shall start with you. What would you like to plug this evening?
You know, I actually want to do a different plug first. I want to plug a little shop here in Kansas City called Bebop Comics. These are the guys I always buy my comics from. It's a small, privately owned company. These guys have a great selection, and they've always gotten me my books for source material. I cannot recommend them enough if you're in the Kansas City area. My company, Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geeky. We are currently in our down season. We're not going to start going to conventions again until March. That's when we're doing Planet Comic Con. So at the time being, we are doing God knows how much data analysis and entry, and making me want to just, you know, ram my head into a wall. But we are going to be starting some new projects, working on a few new pieces. And of course, you can always find us on Facebook, Instagram, and under Protest Twitter. And we have our two shops on Etsy and Handmade at Amazon. Even though it's our down season, our stores are fully stocked. You can find tons of one-of-a-kind geek-themed merchandise. Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and cheap.
Al Sedano, my man, tell everybody where they can find you, listen to some of the great stuff that you have in your archive. I know I've been doing it for quite a while, so.
You can find me at Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, which is all about the Marvel characters. Well, Adam Warlock and Thanos, pretty obvious. You can find it wherever you find podcasts, just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos, it's going to pop up. Or go to our main page, which is Tumblr. ResurrectionsAdamWarlock.tumblr.com. Right now, the show's on a brief hiatus, but we're going to be coming back in a month or two, finishing out the 70s stories of Adam Warlock and Thanos.
Sounds great. I look forward to hearing that. I'm going to throw my old hand plugs in here at the end. I guess, you know, hey, shout out to our good buddy Mark Radulich, who, yes, he was not able to be here tonight, but we appreciate the ever-loving hell out of him for letting us use the network to talk and present our discussions on some of the stuff that we love in comics. Thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be talking to you next week. Have a good one. For Alexis Haina and for Al Sedano, my name is Jesse Starcher. Bye-bye.
Anti-monitor.
Thank you all for joining us. Make sure to give that Radulich in Broadcasting Facebook page a like to stay up on top of all the great podcasts we have to offer. We are at home on Spreaker, but you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and recently we have hit the air on Spotify. Find your favorite podcast platform and type in RADULICH to subscribe for some great content. If you enjoyed this show, please feel free to share and spread the word. And as always, we appreciate any feedback and look forward to entertaining you again soon.
Even though it's not the right Wonder Woman. It's not his Wonder Woman. That's the Earth 2 Superman holding Earth 1 Wonder Woman.
And the smoke's coming out of my ears. I think there's something.
Podcast. We are coming at you with episode 259. That's right, I believe. No, might be 260. You know what? I screwed that up already. I don't want to talk about this ever again. This is the final time I'm talking. This is the final crisis on the Source Material Podcast.
Matter and antimatter. Yeah, you're right. This does get confusing.
Yeah, it was fun. It was so matter- fun to type this shit out 90,000 times. I'll tell you that much. The universe is born.
And then I use antibacterial soap in that universe. And maybe that's the antimatter. It's just antibacterial soap.
It's anti-monitor bacterial soap. Oh, that was a bad joke. Okay. Yeah, I'll be saying antimatter and anti-monitor at work tomorrow for no reason.
Websites that say that Goku would kill Superman. I've given up trying to find reason on the internet.
Goku!
Yeah, and it also depends which version and which Saiyan. I mean...
Oh my god, we are getting so off topic.
Goku! I'm always up for a spirited debate, but it ain't happening on a freaking Crisis episode, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, why not? Let's sort of Earth Dragon Ball.
I think it's just a sign that as much as we all love this comic, we all admit how exhausting it is about this. So it's like, we love this book. Can we talk about something easier, please?
Please. And then we'll talk about Goku versus Superman.
Oh, right. Just go to Death Battle on YouTube.
Okay, we'll watch it. Eddie, is that Eddie?
Yeah.
Someone's home?
He's demanding attention.
Scratch his belly, rub his back. Yes,
okay,
are.
So I'm explaining Superboy Prime.
Tell us all about your fandom of Superboy Prime.
That asshole.
No one's a fan of Superboy Prime. That's why when you said you needed someone to talk about it, I said not it.
The anti-monitor, world's anti-monitor, anti-matter. I just had to say it one more time.
So who here is sick to death of saying anti-matter and anti-monitor?
My hand was raised last night.
Shirts and skins.